This is Behind the Docs, the show that shines a spotlight on the people shaping how we understand and use technology. In each episode, we pull back the curtain to talk about what it's really like to create the docs we all rely on. Let's dive in.
Hi, and welcome to Behind the Docs. I'm your host, Patrick Bozek, and with me today, I have Carissa Van Ballen. Welcome, Carissa.
Hello, how are you?
I am great. How are you doing?
I'm alive. That's all that matters right now.
Standing on ground and sucking air, right?
That's all I can hope for, really.
Well, I guess that's pretty common these days. You know, some people feel that there's a lot of things coming at us, especially in technical communication, learning, and knowledge management. So unsurprised, but I'm very excited to have you on today and discussing your journey through technical communication. So before we jump in and we start talking about some of the big things that you've done over the course of the last, you know, decade or so, why don't you just give us a little background about who you are and, you know, kind of your relation to the technical communication?
Yeah. So like Patrick said, I'm Carissa Van Ballen. I've been in this tech communication customer education scene probably around like 11 years now, 10 years now. A very long time. I started in customer support specifically, just trying to feel out like what I really liked and, you know, what was going on. And then it just eventually kind of grew into this like knowledge management and customer education scene, learning what customer education really was, kind of allowing that to grow my career out, trying to grow teams and eventually led me to being a director of education. So anything knowledge management, anything education, anything that some people might find boring, which I do not, is definitely like my area of focus.
Yeah, well, I don't find it boring. And I think anybody who's listening to this podcast is not going to find it boring because they wouldn't be here otherwise. But I think we all agree with you. This is really interesting and fun stuff. So you came in through service.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the transition from, you know, thinking of it as service, that was kind of where you were in the world, to actually being more on the education knowledge management side of things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I started at Hotjar. When I started, it was a very small company. I was, I think, like number 23. And at the end, before we were acquired, there was about, I think 300 of us. So like I was amazing. I mean, it was probably one of my favorite like periods of my career, to be honest. But I started in support specifically. I was interested in things like, you know, like JavaScript, HTML, CSS, like, oh, cool, I can do all this stuff. And basically we were, the support team in the beginning was very heavily used because it was such a technical tool. But over time, things got a little easier. Our product team grew. I mean, they were able to explain the product better. So we still obviously needed a big support team. But because we were so small, there was a lot of things to do. Like when you're in a startup that small, it's like, okay, your role is X, but we still need you to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Like, oh, have you ever done marketing before? You know, like it's just, you wear a lot of hats. You know, you're trying to help the team, you're trying to go in a single direction. And the one thing that really stood out was documentation for me. It was the help center where I wanted to read the entire help center. I was like, oh, I'm going to read it from front to back. And at the time, there was nobody who was creating the documentation. It was kind of, you know, oh, an engineer made a feature, so he just wrote something up really quick. And, oh, the founder decided to add this feature, so he just wrote. And so there was no unified tone. There was no unified, that thing was unified. It literally sounded like just every individual person was writing documents for the company. And that's what it was. That's what was happening. So we were at that point where I was like, okay, well, can I own this? And my lead was like, yeah, sure. And I was like, all right, great. I just started going through all the pieces of documentation, and I was introduced to Write the Docs community. Specifically, it was a conference in Budapest, I believe, or Prague. It's a conference in Prague. And I didn't know at the time that even being in documentation was a career choice. I didn't know, you know, like I knew there was technical writers, sure. But like, I just didn't know like, oh, people like manage knowledge bases for a living. And oh, people, like, it was just crazy to me. And I absolutely loved it. Like I went to this conference and I was just blown away. I was like, oh, this is it. Like, this is where I need to be.
Isn't it funny how this is like never shows up on like a career day or anything like that?
Never. And it's so crazy too, because like, if you think about, I don't know, you think about technical writers, right? Where you can have a technical writer that works in a knowledge base. You also can have just a content creator or just a writer in a knowledge base. They don't necessarily have to be technical writer. But when you take courses to become a technical writer, you try to get your different types of certification. A lot of the content that's still out there is very focused on what technical writing was in the beginning, you know, like manuals for microwaves, manuals for cars. Like it seems like now there's a bit of a shift and you can start getting technical writing specific courses for like tech companies or for online stores, but it's taken a while to catch up. And so now again, like, I mean, over the past maybe 5 years, these type of courses started showing up even in universities as like majors or like areas that you specialize in. But I was like, oh my God, there were so many people there too. Like, I think there was like 200 people there. It was crazy. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And everybody was talking about, you know, oh, how do you, and just literally just spilling their guts on like how they're doing, how they're managing the documentation, how they're looking at it, how they do the strategy. And that's when I kind of realized that, you know, if you're in product, if you're a product manager or you're a marketer or you're content, you know, a lot of the times when you're in those specific industries, you know, there's 1,000,005 books. Everyone's like, oh, this is our marketing Bible. This is our, you know, this is our go-to book to read for product design. But like, that just doesn't really exist for, I mean, now it does a bit with like Daniel Quick's book. And then before it was kind of just like, you're reading a book about information architecture, you're reading a book about content creation for marketing, you're reading, you know, you're talking to the person that you're friends with that knows the person that's customer success manager of this company, and you're just trying to piece this career or these ideologies and strategy together.
Yeah, there's definitely like the traditional group, and those people are now kind of colliding with the more modern necessity of having like customer experience and support and all those kinds of like groups that come together to actually form experiences. And that transition has been really interesting to watch. So you feel like a decade is a long time in this industry. I'm not going to tell you how long I've been in this industry, I think, if that's a long time. But like when we started, you know, it was all about PDFs, and it was just like everybody was producing a manual, and we've gotten to watch this entire like sea change as the people like starting to wake up and realize that it's about the experience. It's about the actual answer that people get.
Yeah. And I think experience kind of plays a lot into it. Even how you're like delivering the content as well, where a lot of the times if you're working a relatively new company or a company who's not used to the resources needed for documentation, for customer education, they kind of just go to, you know, oh, it's just this, or, oh, it just takes a little bit of, you just need to put this together in a document and whip it up, right? Where it's like, okay, yeah, well, there's many pieces to customer education. Obviously, there's the content, there's also the delivery of the content. There's also the UI. There's also the experience that the user's having or they're having from start to finish. You know, where on the customer cycle are you actually serving this content? You know, there's so many different pieces to it. And it's a puzzle. It's a fun puzzle, though.
It is. And it's one that you can progressively iterate on, right? So, you know, when you're talking about the overall information experience that you're delivering to your customer or even employees, good doesn't have to be perfect. Like you can add pieces along the way. You can like feel it out and continue to iterate on it. But it is. It's a very, very fun puzzle. I think that actually leads really nicely into one of the questions I wanted to ask you, which is that, you know, you started in this very small company that grew into, you know, a pretty sizable organization, got acquired, and now you've had another experience. So like, what are some of the things that you've seen that are like common misperceptions about the role of being a content, manager inside of knowledge, learning, customer education, documentation, or generally related to the field?
Yeah. I mean, there's a good few. I feel like a struggle that no matter who I talk to in customer education, whether they've been in it for 5 minutes or 500 years, right? Like, there's the struggle of trying to express why what we do is important. And that doesn't mean that you ever aren't going to get lucky, right? And you go into a company that's like, I'm CEO and I've been in front of and behind customer ed orgs before, or just education, knowledge management support, so I know how important it is. But like, something that comes up a lot, doesn't matter if someone's reaching out to me on LinkedIn or if it's someone that I know personally in the industry, it's like, how did you get your manager to do X? How did you get your director, your VP, or one of your executive stakeholders to do Y? You know, like, it's always that question, and it's always different, and it's a struggle that we all face. Because there's a lot of misconceptions of people thinking, oh, you need to write a document for a feature release that we have, and if it should take you like 10 minutes, you'll be fine, you know? Which, for someone who doesn't know, maybe. But I mean, for us, we're like, okay, well, we need bullet points understanding how this new feature is going to work. We need screenshots. We need videos, maybe. We need, illustrations, depending on what kind of tool you have or what kind of software you're writing for. I need examples. I need use cases. I need, who is this for? Who's the person? Like, there's so many questions, and there's so many ways to go about content strategy when you're trying to teach someone something. And a lot of times it does not click for some executives. It takes a while. It takes a really hard, long time to get them to understand, like, oh, this is actually something really important.
Yeah, I think that almost anybody listening to this can relate to that to one degree or another. It's so uncommon that you have executives that really understand the value of doing content strategy. I'd like to believe that that's changing a little bit, because I think that people are realizing that content's kind of the foundation of experiences. Mm-hmm. But it is, as you've very correctly pointed out, such a detailed practice and such a nuanced skill that I don't think you're ever going to get somebody who's in the executive level, unless they have that unique background you described.
Exactly.
Be like, oh yeah, obviously I get this stuff. Like, it's so far away from what they deal with.
Yeah. It's, I've been in a situation before where I've had a director or a VP who was 100% behind me from start to finish, who was reading books that I was suggesting and trying to fully understand and grasp what was going on, and just my biggest advocate, and, making sure that customer education was known, and all the way to, the other end of the spectrum of like, yeah, well, our goal is to, eventually not need documentation because our UI is so, and our product is so intuitive. And it's just, I always, that one was hard, but it was like, I always go back to, you could have a website with a green button that says push on it. That's the only thing that's there. And you will still get emails of, how many times do I click, right click or left click? What happens after I push it? Should I push it too much? What happens if I click 7 times? Is it okay if I push this if I don't have a computer? How do I push it if I don't have a computer? Like, just all, you'll get every question under the sun that are ranged from crazy to insane to maybe make sense. Like, it's just, it is not possible not to have any type of documentation. Like, it's just not.
Completely agree. And with that button, which is, I love that. I love that example.
Yeah.
If there's just one button to push, that's terrifying. I want to read something that's going to reassure me as to what happens after I push that button. I mean, even if the button's green, which is much nicer than it being red, but like, God forbid it's a red button. Like, what is the result of pushing that button? Like, there better be documentation that tells me what happens.
Is this destruction? Like, what is this? Like, what am I doing? Yeah.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult to navigate. And I feel like sometimes I think it's particularly scary when you move companies as well as a customer education professional, because you just never know what you're going to get. When you start, you might be like, okay, this is great. Or you might be like, oh no, they want to hire me for education, but they might not know. And I've seen it happen to even like the most incredible education professionals mm-hmm. where they're just like, oh, this is going to be a great move. And they're like, they don't understand why a new feature release takes 2 weeks to, on the low end, takes mm-hmm. 2 weeks for us to like plan out and create. And I'm like, yeah, that happens. That happens.
Probably more than we'd like to admit.
Yeah.
So you had the opportunity to do this kind of advocacy, internal education, those kinds of things to, you know, kind of get over some of these hurdles, which I think you've done really successfully in a smaller organization. And in my career, I've seen that smaller organizations, especially ones that are moving fast, like Hotjar was, those can often be the most challenging to get visibility on the importance of customer education and the content behind it. Like, what were some of the things that you did that you felt were particularly successful?
I feel like because, yes, there are those negatives of it's particularly difficult, right? Resources, you know, depending on which way the company is going, maybe they're going to be customer focused, maybe they're going to be product focused, but whatever way the company's been and decides to go, you know, that's where the main resources are going to go. So if you decide to go more product, okay, well, you need to figure out how to document with a huge product team. You know, there's a lot of those type of hurdles. But a benefit of these startups and just working for a fairly quick or fast-paced team was the experimentation side. And so I feel like most of, if not all, of the successes that I've had are just due to the wiggle room that I was able to have for experimentation. So we would do things like, you know, try different layouts for content. We would say, hey, let's do something really crazy. And we don't know if video documentation is really going to work for our user base. So we're going to just spend resources to create 10 videos and just all like one after the other, publish them all, and then do surveys in order to get our results to say like, okay, is this something that we're going to do? We wanted to create certification, but we wanted the certification not to be something that, I don't know, I feel like a lot of companies can have certifications for it. And that's fine. And, you know, I wanted the certification to mean something. So I wanted to be kind of like a HubSpot certification where it's like, oh, you're HubSpot certified. You know how to use this tool. This is great. I wanted the same thing. Oh, you're Hotjar certified. That means you can use the tool. This is actually a skill for you in order to get a job. And so we made this crazy system where we created all the content for our courses, and we did this set up this very homemade testing. So we required, okay, after you finished all of the course content for level one course, you have 30 days to use our tool, and you have to do at least 5 of these 10 things, or it was like 4 of these 10 things. And one of them required was you have to log in once a week, right? So you're making a power user because I have to log in once a week. Then if that's your definition of power user, ours was once or 4 times in 28 days, right? So you have to log in once a week. Then depending on what the course content was, we wanted them to do these actions within our tool. So we want you to create a heat map. We want you to watch a recording. We want you to use filters. We want you to, you know, make a survey. And monitoring what they're doing on Mixpanel, because we had access to Mixpanel. And then that was the way, you know, that we were going to say, okay, once you do this within a 30-day period, you get your certification. And it was scary because we didn't know if it was going to work. This was all built. This was all like, I borrowed time from people. This wasn't like a template that you get off of an LMS. It was just, you do it. And it was massively successful. And it, you know, it's unfortunate that it's not unfortunate we got acquired, but it's unfortunate that we started blending the products together. So we didn't really keep the same structure, but like, we went from, I think like zero, it was like at the beginning, obviously zero. I think we had 100 in the first month. And then after the second month, we had like 2,000 people who were taking courses. And then specifically that type of certification of the 30 days, after the first 30-day period, we had like 500 people that had it. And like, these were people that continued to be power users afterwards. And we continued we increased their retention. We reduced the churn. We were monitoring all those metrics as well to also benefit the product team. You know, like, okay, look what we're doing with retention, look what we're doing with churn. You know, the CSMs who have these particular profiles, okay, cool. Look, they're now using this. They've taken the certification. You should go talk to them and talk to them about this particular product. You know, like, really just, it was aiding the whole ecosystem of customer experience. So that was massive. It was absolutely massive. And I mean, also just big basic stuff of like, hey, we want to start serving content within the help center that's specific to what their actions are in the tool. And mm-hmm. So we really wanted to focus on self-service at that point. And you know, at one time we were way over, like, I think like 4,000 tickets a month. Like, we were getting so many tickets, and it was a problem because some of the things that we could do, like that were like really technical tickets, obviously those have to be done, but there's a lot of self, like billing questions, changing account owner, things like that, that they could be solved if they were given the content at the right time.
What was your ratio? Did you guys measure it?
Yeah. So we converted the ratio to a number. So sorry, I can't do fast math. But in the beginning, our self-service score was probably around, I think it was like 18, 17, okay. 18. So for every one ticket made, 17 people were, you know, self-served, basically.
That's not bad.
No, it was pretty good. But we were still getting a huge amount of tickets in. So we started really small and, again, basic because we didn't really have a lot of resources. So one of the things we did was hijack our Zendesk form. And basically, if someone wanted to talk to us about changing the account owner, it immediately, if they selected it on the dropdown for a contact form, it like popped up call out box. And it was like, hey, have you done X, Y, and Z first? And then if it was yes or no, if they said yes, then they can send it to us because there was a couple steps they had to do on their end before we were account owner change. If it was no, then we directly sent them to that piece of documentation and said, this is how you do it. And we didn't stop their form. Right? Like, they still were able to contact us because a lot of times when people talk about self-service score, they think about creating friction. So it's not, self-service score is not about friction in the easiest sense of the word, right? Like, you want to kind of do the opposite. You want to reduce the number of tickets that are coming in, but you want to do it in a way that's a good experience for your user. You don't want to like start putting pop-ups and stuff that's going to stop them from submitting a ticket. Then it's the opposite of self-service, because then you just have a really annoyed person.
Right. You have an annoyed person contacting support, or a really annoyed person versus just an annoyed person.
Or you have someone just cancel. Like, that happens where people are just like, nope, I'm done. And they just cancel their account and they move on. Totally. So that's always a really big misconception when people talk about self-service, is they just think about friction, and it's no, opposite of friction. So just sort of implementing small. Oh, go ahead.
I want to jump into that a little bit deeper, but I want to kind of loop back to just like the strategies you employed on getting attention on this, because I thought that, you know, through these stories, there was like a really, really interesting theme. So would I be mischaracterizing this if I said that your strategy was to build things and show them rather than pitch ideas?
Yeah. It's almost like taking the ask for forgiveness rather than permission route, I guess.
I was going to say that. And did it feel that way when you were doing it? Where you were like,
100%, 100%, a million times yes. Like, and it was always, in the beginning, it was always this feeling of like, oh my God, am I going to get fired for doing this? Like, this is crazy. But at the end of the day, I feel like even if something failed miserably and burned to the ground, mm-hmm. it was still a learning experience for us of like, this is what our customer 100% doesn't want, right? And it's not even like running to the ground because of like, sure, we can talk about your executive or your stakeholder thinking about the time that you're wasting or the salary or, you know, how many people or resources you're using. But like, customer trust is a limited resource. So if you want to test something, you need to make sure that you as sure hell believe in it. Because if you don't, and you get to the person and it messes up their and breaks any trust they have with you, that's it. Like, you might not get that back. So that was more scary to me than getting like a slap on the wrist. was us losing the trust of the customer over them being like, oh, Carissa, you shouldn't have done that for a quarter. You know, I didn't mind that. What I minded was, oh my God, we did this experiment with 800 users and they're all pissed off. You know, that terrified me.
I mean, as it should.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
I mean, trying to get really practical here. You know, technical writers can be very practical people. Did you, like, there's obviously a balance between, like, you know, just completely running off in your own direction and doing whatever you want, mm-hmm. and then asking for permission every step of the way before doing something. Like, can you give a little bit of advice on, you know, how do you find that? Like, how do you build and run an experiment without having to go and ask for permission, but still kind of, like, you know, keeping it on the I'm not going to get fired side of the line? Like, how do you walk up to the line but don't walk over it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's the dream line, right? You want to be able to get to that point. I mean, it's hard to see sometimes. I feel like if at the end of the day, though, right, no matter who you're reporting to or how they feel about education, if you come with receipts, it's really hard to debate the receipts, right? So for me, if I'm thinking about, okay, we need to improve self-service, and we don't really have a lot of resources and we have a lot of deadlines we need to meet, like, what is the biggest problem for self-service? So I would start with just bullet points of what are our highest ticket issues? What is something that's always coming up, even for the product team? What's something that's always coming up for the product team that they think that's an issue? Asking the CSMs, what's always coming up on your training calls? Sales team, what's always coming up when people are saying why they want to use our tool? And just making this bullet point list. But I'd say, like, 9 times out of 10, it's support tickets. We would spend hours and hours reading through support tickets. And at this point, the help center, knowledge management, customer education, whatever you want to call it, team was no longer in support. But we still had access to Zendesk. We were still reading all of those tickets. And, you know, making it a lot of times, especially when it comes to support, support people are in the tickets all day, every day. Some issues feel bigger than they are. Some issues feel smaller than they actually are. And it's because, you know, if the person's getting 30 tickets a day of creating the same issue over and over again, you want to raise the alarm bells. But is it 30 people because it's a huge problem? Or is it 30 people because you randomly got those 30 people for that problem? You know, so we just went with metrics. We would go through, we would, you know, if someone was yelling, there's a fire over here, we'd look, is there really a fire or is it, you know, a kindling? You know, what's going on? And if I had those receipts to back our idea, then it's like there's literally no reason why we shouldn't try what we're trying. If it's not affecting OKR status, if it's not affecting anything that we need to get done or deadlines we need to hit, then let's try. You know some JavaScript? Cool. Can you whip me up some extra JavaScript on the Zendesk contact form and see if it helps reduce tickets even by one a day, you know, and just trying it out that way.
And so it's almost like solve somebody else's problem.
Always. Always.
Yeah. So you listed support, that's the obvious one, but you're also mm-hmm. like, you know, what are the CSMs running into? What are the salespeople running
yeah.
into?
Yeah.
And it's hard to get mad if you're like, well, I was trying to solve the problem for these guys because they have this issue.
And that's the thing. At the end of the day, it's always difficult as well, because you sometimes get into like the territory race where someone's like marketing, like, oh, we own that. And CSM's like, oh, we own that. And, but at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter who owns what. Our goals are all the same. Our goals are we want our user to be able to successfully use a tool and be happy while they're doing it and still continue to use our tool and not churn. Like, it's the same. Yeah. The same is the same, but the same is the same. So it's like, if I can identify an area that this is a problem for you, you know, specifically that change of account owner issue that we have with support, we reduced ticket reach out for change of account owner by 51%. That's like, that's huge. That's half the tickets that the account agents were getting. Specifically to change account owner form, just slashed. Mm-hmm. Done. So it's like, okay, well, obviously you can't get mad at that. Oh, you did an experiment? No, you can't get mad at that, you know? So we did all these tiny experiments like that over and over again, you know, got up to that line every time. And then sometimes being like, sometimes asking for permission, hey, can I just can I just ask this engineer for help for something, you know, like, can I just borrow him, you know? But we got the self-service score from 18 to like 45 in a quarter and a half, two quarters, just overlaying. It was insane. And we didn't believe it. No one believed it. And I did all this metric reporting and I was pulling all these numbers. And I was like, we're saving about, you know, $1 million a year on just support resources alone. And the executive team were like, yeah, whatever. And then just randomly, and I think this, I don't know who it was, and I thank this person every day, this random Zendesk CSM got on a call with a couple of our executives because they were just, we had a big enterprise package, whatever. And they said, did you guys know that you guys are saving 1.8 million euros a year? And they were like, oh. And we're like, yeah, we did the calculation. So my calculations were way too conservative. I was saying a million, but it was 1.8 million. And like, I can't, whoever that CSM was, thank you. Because like that changed. That was when finally the executive team were like, oh, what's Carissa doing? What's education doing? What? Oh, you know, like, oh, let's talk to them a little bit about that. Do you guys need anything? And I'm like, we need a lot of stuff. We need a lot of stuff. So yeah,
1.8 million a year worth of stuff is a week.
Yeah, that's what we need. Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's difficult because like even sometimes when you have the numbers, it doesn't matter until you have that third party just come in and be like, do you know what you're saving?
So that, I wonder if there's a way that can become more of an actionable thing is get someone else to tell your story. And I feel like that kind of fits nicely with the concept of solve somebody else's problem. Like if you can solve somebody else's problem and then also bring somebody else in to tell the story, it probably does lend a lot of credibility.
Well, credibility as well for, I mean, it's not for nothing, but Zendesk is pretty big, right? So if you're us ourselves as a company are spending money to use Zendesk, the executives are getting on a call with Zendesk because they want to use the tool the most efficient way they can. Then coming from them, you know, it's kind of hard. They're not going to say no. They can say no to me. They can be like, I don't know if the numbers are right. They're not going to say that to their CSM or to the executive from Zendesk that they're talking to. They're not going to be like, oh, I don't know about your numbers. They're going to be like, oh, that's great. You know, it's just.
Right. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, you know, your numbers can be like, oh, well, they're just showing me that. Like, it's, but if somebody else does a calculation, it's like, oh my gosh, like, you know, that person doesn't have a dog in this fight, even though
exactly
does. They do, absolutely 100%, but like, it feels a little different.
Yeah.
So that's I love that entire framework, right? So like you had a methodology of kind of winning with small experiments. And even I think just that terminology, experiments versus projects, is such a big difference because like, if you're just running an experiment, that's not a big deal. Like everybody wants people to experiment, try to find new things. It's not like trying to greenlight a project or needing a project plan. There's none of those kinds of things. I think that's interesting and compelling. And then all the way up through like solving other people's problems, like getting other people to advocate for you. I think that's all just super actionable and helpful advice for the people who are trying to make gains in this industry.
Yeah. It's, I mean, like I said, it's scary. It's a puzzle. But like even that, like even with the experiments, we still had like project plans, right? Because like we're like, okay, this is an experiment. We know it might not work, but we still had some of those plans. Like not as much as like a business case presenting, like you're talking about presenting. Oh, Q1, I'm going to do this. Q2, I'm going to do this. It's just like, yeah, we're going to run these two experiments. My team knows that we have a step by step project plan that we're going to be following for this experimentation. But like, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, you know. We know for them, it doesn't work because it's an experiment. But for us, we're like, okay, we're banking. This is going to work. Or like, this isn't going to work. Or what are we going to learn from this failing?
100%. And I think that's actually probably a great place to leave things. Like we're kind of running out of time here. And this has been a really, really fun conversation. Thank you so much for your insights and you know how to break into creating knowledge management, customer experience, education. And things like that in small organizations, and then how to get a lot of traction through experiments.
Yeah, of course. I'm, like I said, I could talk about this stuff for days and days. So I love to do it.
Well, thank you so much for being on Behind the Docs, and we'll hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Docs, where the content's structured, but the conversations aren't. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and share it with someone who loves great documentation as much as we do. Until next time, keep creating content that makes a difference.